This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Noelle Lim. Globally, since December, over 40,000 people have been infected and more than 1,000 people have died from the novel coronavirus, or now known as COVID-19. To learn more about the challenges of fighting diseases from animals to human beings, we speak with David Kwanman, author of several award-winning books, Spillover, The Reluctant Mr. Darwin, and The Song of the Dodo. When researching for Spillover, he journeyed across Bangladesh to catch Nipah virus-carrying fox bats and to the forests of Central Africa to get close to gorillas infected by Ebola and to the borders of Congo and Cameroon to study chimpanzees with HIV. Thank you for joining us. How worried should we be about COVID-19?
Being worried is pointless because there are hundreds of thousands of people each year who die of seasonal influenza. The fatality rate for influenza is much lower than this is so far. So this is serious. And yet there are things we can do, things we must do to control it. And worrying is the least useful of them.
How would you rate China's responses so far in dealing with this epidemic?
Disease scientists, people I know, such as Peter Daszak of EcoHealth Alliance, a very professional organization, works a lot in China. He has been very positive about the response from China so far. The genome sequence of the new virus was received very quickly. And yet others are pointing out that responses of officials in Wuhan, Hubei, let me put it politely and say not transparent. There was suppression of the bad news, it seems, and that may have been very damaging in the early days and first couple of weeks. More needs to be done. More research about where this particular virus came from, more preparation, more efforts, not just to control this viral epidemic, but to learn from it. There's a saying from a smart American political figure, Rahm Emanuel, never let a serious crisis go to waste.
The World Health Organization, WHO, came under fire for underestimating the severity of this Wuhan coronavirus. But in 2010, it was accused of declaring swine flu a pandemic to benefit pharmaceutical companies. How effective is the WHO so far?
The words epidemic, outbreak, epidemic, and pandemic are somewhat vague words that public health officials try and give concrete meaning to. And I think the concrete meaning of pandemic is an outbreak of disease to a number of different countries around the world on at least two different continents and is creating, I believe it's hundreds of cases in those several countries on two different continents. If that's the measure, then this is not yet a pandemic, but there's every reason to believe that this will soon become a pandemic. WHO received a lot of criticism also after the 2014 Ebola virus epidemic in West Africa. There was a lot of criticism. I have not directly reported on WHO. So what I know about WHO comes from a few reports and general press coverage. I'm a little reluctant to criticize them on the basis of that. And I will say that it's a very, very difficult task to judge in advance how big a new viral outbreak is going to be. Swine flu in 2009, bird flu in 1997, SARS in 2003, Ebola 2014, and now this novel, quote-unquote, novel coronavirus. There is a very, very high degree of randomness in the way these viruses change and develop. And there is also a lot of unpredictability in human behavior. So you put those two sources of unpredictability together, and it's very, very hard to predict where the trajectory is going to go. In my New York Times op-ed, I compared it to a pinball machine, and you can smack at it with your flippers, and still, for all your efforts, there will be 11 levels of uncertainty that finally falls in a hole. And likewise with these viral outbreaks.
You've said the outbreak of this coronavirus is to some extent quite predictable. Could you tell us more about that?
Yes. Yes, that's the frustrating, heartbreaking thing about this. I mean, I published my book Spillover in 2012. So in 2010 and 11, as I was finishing it, I asked some of the world's leading disease scientists, infectious disease scientists, for their predictions about whether there would be a next new big one, and if so, what would it look like? And some of the best people on this in the world said to me, well, coronaviruses are one of the families, and coronavirus was mentioned by these experts back then. They said it'd probably be, oh, maybe a coronavirus coming out of an animal species, oh, maybe in a wet market in China. Back in 2012, I was reporting their predictions, and that's what they were saying.
They've done all this research, and they've gone to the caves and studied the bats, and they have made their prediction about coronaviruses. Why didn't the government listen to them?
Why don't governments listen to scientists? Why doesn't the Chinese government listen more carefully to its wonderful scientists at places, at institutions like the Wuhan Institute of Virology? Why doesn't the government of the U.S. listen more carefully to the independent scientists that I followed around the world who study these things, and the scientists at the CDC? I don't have an answer for that. They should. And yet in our country, there's more and more resistance to the expertise of scientists. The funding has been reduced over and over again in the last 3 years under this administration for the CDC and for pandemic preparedness generally. It's crazy. It's not cost efficient. It's costly in dollars. It's costly in lives. It's costly in suffering. It's costly in lost productivity. There's no rational excuse for it, except that the governments, the bureaucrats and the politicians have their heads in the sand.
You know, science can go against the needs of business, the needs of economic development. Business interests trump scientific evidence.
If that's the case, and there is some logic to that, then they're just not paying attention to the data, because this outbreak is going to be much, much more costly to business interests, like the airlines, like China Airlines, like American Airlines, like Delta Airlines, like Singapore Airlines, to the economy of China, to the manufacturing in China, global oil prices. These things are being impacted heavily by this this crisis event. Wealth is being lost in huge quantities day by day as this thing goes on. Prevention is so much less expensive than reaction.
Do we need to rethink how research papers on contagious viruses can be fast-tracked? I mean, might that help researchers get their messages out more quickly?
Yes. And Noelle, it's happening, you know, it's happening. It used to be, even back at the time of SARS, there was competition over who had isolated and identified this strange new agent that was causing SARS. And there was a lab in Hong Kong, and there was a lab at the CDC in Atlanta. And they essentially were racing one another, but they were racing through the old method, which is going through peer-reviewed science. But nowadays, we have fast-track online publishing of preprints, of drafts of new articles, and those are produced and put online, and people can see them, and they are provisional. They have not yet been peer-reviewed by other scientists, so they are taken as provisional, and yet it's valuable to get that information, at least those hypotheses and the support for those hypotheses with the data that has been gathered. It's important to get them up as fast as possible. And one example of that is a paper that came out of the Wuhan Institute of Virology on January 23rd. And it was the discovery of a novel coronavirus associated with recent outbreak, humans, and its potential bat origin. This was January 23rd. It went up online. The senior author is a woman scientist in Wuhan named Zhengli Shi. First author is Peng Zhu. And it was a very important paper to get up there. Now it'll be peer reviewed and hopefully move from provisional to very, very reliable science. But when it went up on January 23rd, it was vastly better than having no information at all.
I'm wondering, is there a role that insurance companies can play? Like, I'm not sure whether these researchers can be covered by insurance. For example, if something happens to them, they're exposed to the virus and they pass away.
Yeah, well, that's a good question. Insurance companies, because insurance companies are very clear-eyed and rational about the level of risk. Insurance companies don't tend to include a lot of climate change deniers because the consequences of being wrong about that are so large. Insurance companies, the smart ones, probably also realize what I've been saying, which is that the costs of response to a global viral pandemic are much, much higher than the costs of prevention. And so the insurance companies, if they're smart, will be looking at all this stuff, and they'll be talking to the businesses that they insure, for instance, airlines, and saying, look, you need to have coverage for this sort of event. You could lose hundreds of millions of dollars in a short time. We will insure you against that, but you have to pay the real costs of that insurance, which includes the possibility, almost a likelihood, that these events will occur. So insurance companies could be very, very influential in a very salubrious, good way at being intermediaries between the science that's being done that says these events will occur, they will repeat, and the business world that wants to be braced against disaster, wants to be braced against the black swan. Insurance companies have, I think, a really, really valuable potential role to play in this.
We are speaking with David Kwanman, author of the book Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. Later, we'll discuss preventive steps and his predictions of the next epidemic.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Today on the Breakfast Grill, we're speaking with David Kwanman, author of the book Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. The Chinese authorities were aware that SARS was caused by viruses in bats. Why is it that they did not ban the consumption of wildlife? Where do you think is the weakest link in the system?
Right after SARS, the national government of China, working through the provincial governments, did close the wildlife markets, the wet markets, as they call them. They were closed down, but then there was, and you talked about business, there was reaction from the business community, from the sellers who ran those markets and worked through the wholesale through those markets. And then they were allowed to open back up. And even in cases where the trade and wild animals captured from the wild, as opposed to captive bred, even where those were closed down in terms of the legalities, there has been an underground trade through the through restaurants, through the back doors of restaurants, through under the tables at the markets. You know, you have to know someone and say the right thing and not be suspicious, not be suspected to be some sort of an investigator, and you can still get these wild animals. That has to be stopped.
Scientists are now racing against time to work out the vaccine. I understand it might take a year. We need to shorten the amount of time between the emergence of a new disease and a vaccine and getting the vaccine out. How can we do so realistically while ensuring vaccines are safe?
Anthony Fauci, Dr. Tony Fauci, head of the NIAID, a big infectious disease institute in the U.S., said that a couple of days ago. It might take up to a year, which is crazy long. It's difficult. It's a time frame that it was helpful for the next one, but not helpful for this one. How do you shorten that? I don't know. Vaccines have to be grown in live cells, and it just takes time. You can't. There are steps in the manufacturing process, let alone the research process, and the testing process, the safety confirmation before you give this to millions of humans. All of those bars have to be cleared. But the thing that strikes me that can be done by technology and science that would help enormously would be real-time, fast molecular diagnostics. And what I mean by that are portable machines that could read samples taken from cheek swabs, from saliva, from people at airport security clearance points. Samples could be taken. First of all, people could be tested for temperature. Anybody who has a high temperature are taken aside. That's already being done. Once you take them aside, those people now have to be confined for a matter of hours or days before they can be confirmed infected or not infected. But this technology I'm talking about would be capable of taking a swab from their cheek, running it through a machine, and in the matter of minutes, getting a readout as to whether they are carrying evidence of this particular virus or not. That machine has been under development since I published my book. It's apparently not available yet. or it would be in use. There's a wonderful scientist named Ian Lipkin at the Mailman School of Health, School of Public Health at Columbia University in New York, who has talked about this, who has worked on this. He's in China now himself, I understand. And apparently this technology is not yet ready. When we get it, we'll be able to use science and technology much better to identify genuinely infected people much more quickly, for instance, as they go through a security line at an airport.
And how can we incentivize investors or nonprofits or even governments to invest in developing a universal vaccine ahead of time, or to, you know, have protocols in place so that they could respond more quickly?
Oh, it has to be public-private partnerships, right? These things are too complicated and too interconnected. There are public institutions around the world. I'm sure there's one in Malaysia. I've talked with people at the University of KL about this. There are some brilliant people there working on viruses. There are brilliant people at the CDC in the US and one in China, and there's one in France, and there's one in Britain, and I'm sure there's one in Germany. Those institutions need to be publicly supported. But this is also a great opportunity, as well as almost a social responsibility, for business, for venture capital, to go into funding the sort of technology that I just described, this sort of fast molecular diagnostics readout machine that's portable and works in real time.
SARS was successfully contained before the vaccine was out. Do you foresee this might be the case for the Wuhan virus?
At this point, much harder to contain than SARS was. SARS infected 8,000 people in about five major cities around the world, from Toronto to Singapore, Bangkok, Hong Kong, etc. I sometimes see people saying SARS burned out and we were lucky. SARS did not burn out naturally. SARS was stopped by excellent science and public health measures. What happened was they brought the basic reproduction rate, which is the number of cases of secondary cases who become infected from each first case, from each primary case. That's this crucial reproductive rate. And if it's more than one, then the outbreak becomes an epidemic. It spreads, it multiplies. If it's much more than one, if it's three or four, it multiplies geometrically and spreads fast. If it's less than one, then you've got a handle on it and it starts to be controlled. Public health measures brought this basic reproductive rate for SARS down to 0.4, less than one, and they stopped it. This virus we now have, and there are more every day at a number of cities around the world, major cities, and it's going to be very difficult to get control of it. There's a chance that this thing is going to soon get into Africa, into countries that are struggling and that don't have the healthcare resources that, you know, some other countries do. And when it gets into Africa and to countries such as the Democratic Republic of the Congo or other countries in Central Africa, I just shudder to think how difficult it's going to be to control it under those circumstances.
Bats were the reservoir hosts of Nipah, SARS, and yes. MERS, and likely yes. this Wuhan coronavirus as well. Why do bats harbor significantly higher proportion of zoonotic viruses?
Yes, this is one of the mysterious nagging questions, and scientists have been asking it for 10 or 15 years. Why bats? Why
and not say birds.
And not say birds or reptiles or seafood. Or other animals. Why are bats implicated as the reservoir host in so many of these new emerging viruses? Well, they seem to be implicated in more than their share of cases, and yet their share, just judged by the number of bat species that exist in the world, would be large. One in every four species of mammal in the world is a bat species. 25% of all mammal biological diversity are bats. Very diverse. So to some extent, it just seems like they're overrepresented. But they probably also are overrepresented. A couple of different reasons. They live long lives. They might live 20 years, which is much longer than a mouse will live. They live in huge colonial aggregations where viruses can be passed back and forth from one to another and stay alive in this huge cluster of bats in a cave. And finally, they have immune systems that are a bit different from all other mammal immune systems. Because they fly, their metabolisms are highly stressed, and that releases free DNA, and their immune systems would react against that free DNA, attacking it as though it were something infective, like some DNA from a virus. So it seems now, according to interesting work done just recently, that their immune systems are downregulated to prevent them from having essentially autoimmune troubles all the time, inflammations as their immune systems attack their own DNA that results from the stresses of flying. And so with their immune systems downregulated, then there's other DNA and RNA that can be floating around in their blood in the form of viruses that does not get attacked by their immune system, that's allowed to exist there. So for that reason, they may carry more than their share of strange and sometimes dangerous viruses. But we shouldn't blame bats. Bats are good. The answer is not to kill bats. The answer is to leave bats alone.
What do you foresee will be the next epidemic after this Wuhan coronavirus?
I think that it would be perfectly predictable for there to be a 2023 novel coronavirus and a 2026 novel orthomyxovirus and a 2027 novel paramyxovirus. Again, I'm talking about those other families that have genomes, single-stranded RNA genomes that evolve very quickly. That's what I predict. The next one will also come from a wild animal because that's where unknown viruses live. It might be 5 years, it might be 8 years, it might be 10 years. But what's important is that if it takes 10 years for the next dangerous event like this to happen, we don't forget about it. We don't get complacent. We don't lower our defenses. We need to keep our defenses up because eventually it will happen again.
Thank you for your time and stay safe. David Kwanman, author of Spillover, Animal Infections and the Next Human Pandemic. I'm Noelle Lim on BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile. Unleashing unlimited potential every day.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.